Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you, man?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Well, I'm doing great. Glad to hear you are doing well. You were having a rough time last week, and so it's good to hear that you're on the mend.
Well, you know, it was a crazy couple of days there. Two nights in the hospital, all told, and one trip to the emergency room. Got out on Saturday, and you know, in the end, never completely sure what it was, except that apparently a virus of some kind. So. It's good to be back, doing the show and getting back to normal life. That's for sure. Although the silver lining, I guess, would have to be it gave me plenty to blog about. So
and you did a lot of blogging, so that worked out pretty well. Hey, our guest has joined us. I thought I'll just bring him on into the conversation.
All right, Alex, is that you?
Yes, it's Alex. How are you?
Alex, all right. Well, let me do a proper introduction. Our guest this evening is a CEO, an author, a serial entrepreneur, a traveler, a runner, and certainly the most prolific user of Facebook that I know, more to our purpose this evening, although we might touch on some of that other stuff, time permitting. Alex Lightman is the executive director of H+, a.k.a. Humanity Plus, previously known as the World Transhumanist Society. He has shown himself to be a real mover and shaker in that role, taking H+ in some exciting new directions. Alex is a major influencer and thought leader in the transhumanist movement, and we're very honored to have him with us this evening. Alex Lightman, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor. I did an interview with Phil years ago in San Francisco, and I've had good memories of that experience.
You know, Alex, we were just talking about, Steve and I were scratching our heads before the show started, when we had ever had you on the show before, and we couldn't think of when we had, and I was like, it's impossible that we...
Phil interviewed me with a camera in the lobby of the Exploratorium years ago at an accelerating change event.
I did, and actually, before that, I interviewed you once on the print interview for The Speculist. It was probably the first interview I ever published. Yeah,
on so, 4G. Wireless broadband. I wrote the first book on 4G, Brave New Unwired World, The Digital Big Bang and the Infinite Internet.
That's right. We were talking about that at the Foresight Vision Weekend where you and I met. So I just can't believe, after all these years, that this is the first time we've had you on the program. So we've got a lot of catching up to do, I guess.
We've had the show on 5 years, which means we're exactly 5 years late in getting you on the show. So
That's right.
Better late than never.
Although I will say, Alex, with you, this is kind of like when we had Kurzweil on last year. Although that was the first time he was ever on the program, he has been on almost every episode, every segment we've done, because he's been such an astounding influence on us. And I would say exactly the same for you, that you've been a real influence both on The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio. So it's great to actually close the loop here and have you with us this evening.
Thanks, I appreciate it, and I like your techno optimism. I think if you look at all the possibilities the world has to offer and all your possible reactions to them, that's the one that's the most logical, to be optimistic about the role technology can play in making the world better. So well done being sane.
Yeah, well, it's. I think you're right when you say it's the logical. I mean, the numbers seem to be on the side of the optimistic view. It's not a guarantee that things are going to work out great, but if you play the percentages, the trend has so far been in a pretty good direction.
Well, I think that there's a reason for this. If I could summarize it all, I would call it the ever smarter world, in that you have smarter cars, smarter homes, smarter families, and even smarter materials. And if everything is getting smarter and everything is getting more connected and more information is pumping through the system, and yeah, we're using energy, but there's plenty of energy coming into our biosphere from the sun, and there's gravitational energy and tidal energy, etc. And if it's being used to make things more intelligent, then we're going to have ever greater ability to solve our problems. And that intelligence is increasing exponentially, and that processing power is increasing exponentially, and the connectivity is increasing exponentially. And I don't really see problems increasing exponentially other than that this is the century of what as I like to say, peak oil, peak uranium, peak everything.
That's right. But when things peak, we tend to find other things, don't we? We move
yes,
on.
Yes, that's true. We do. Yes. And so what would you guys like to talk about tonight?
Oh, we're well into it, which is cool. I thought we would clearly want to get into the H+ summit.
Sure.
But
thanks.
I thought
great.
Before we get into that event, why don't we step back and talk a little bit about Humanity Plus, what the organization is all about, and what you've been doing with it since you... Now, you've been in this role for, is it 2 years now, a year and a half?
It's 1 year. It's almost exactly a year. This is my first anniversary. I started around the 20th of May, 2009. So, yeah, let's call this my one-year anniversary.
Wait. And your third summit is coming up, right?
The second summit.
Oh, okay. All right.
The first one was in Irvine, California. The second one is going to be at Harvard University. And the third one will be in December 5th and 6th. I just was at RAND, and I was asking them if we could have it there.
So it sounds like every 6 months?
Yes. I like to have an operational tempo of every 6 months, because it allows us to have continuity of the culture. If you wait a year between events, then there's just too many people who have left their jobs, left their homes, and they've forgotten what the experience was before.
I think that's very wise.
We're switching coasts. So if somebody only does it on the West Coast, then they can come once a year. But if they're willing to fly, then they can do it each 6 months. Because what I've learned from TED, which has been around for 27 years, is that people will sign up for TED without knowing who the speakers are. They'll pay $6,000, and they'll sign up a year in advance. So there's a time cost of their money as well. And TED will sell out, because they know the kind of people who will do that are people who you want to have friendships with for years and years, because they're going to know the coolest things, the most interesting things. They're going to be optimistic. They're going to be curious. They're going to be fun. And they're going to have big social networks. And so you can't really build that up. I can't wait 27 years. So while I can't have the 27 years of TED, what I can do is get TED-quality speakers and have them closer apart, so that we build our community faster, an accelerated community formation.
Sounds like a great model. I'm sorry, I think I stepped on you there, Stephen. Did you have a question?
No, I was just going to say having that do it every 6 months is just another example of the world speeding up. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. It's a clock speed tactic. It's called operational tempo. Increasing the operational tempo is a technique that the U.S. military uses. They go into a conflict, and there's a certain kind of speed, and then they say, okay, how do we double the speed? And people can't really keep up with their lines of communication, and they just have to, go with it. So I want to make sure that with all these different issues to be mixed and matched and figured out, that we sort them out sooner rather than later.
So in addition to having the summits, tell us a little more about the charter of Humanity Plus, what the organization is all about.
Well, it started with Nick Bostrom, Professor Nick Bostrom, at Oxford University in 1998 as World Transhumanist Association. You had said society earlier. It's World Transhumanist Association. WTA. And he was concerned about existential threats to humanity. meteorites and, you know, a sort of a dinosaurus extinction event, plagues and so on, runaway nanotechnology. And so that led to a number of discussions among very smart people, primarily academics, who would say, well, how do we develop human beings so that they can respond to these kind of threats? Now, I wasn't here during those days, but this is my understanding as it's been passed on to me through other people. I met a number of the people who were involved with H-Plus through the Foresight events that Eric Drexler and Christine Peterson had put on during the 90s. I was a senior associate with Foresight. I myself heard about a lot of the transhumanist stuff because of Max Moore and Natasha Vita Moore when they were doing XtraP. I was producing segments on science, technology, and the Internet for a daily TV show called Strange Universe. And so I did a segment on the Extropians, and they, for the first time, put together life extension, intelligence increase, bionics, cybernetics, cryonics, all these kind of things, and made them into a coherent whole that was all built around boundless expansion and techno-optimism. And I liked it, and then I've been looking for a way to play a role myself ever since then. Also, I was just with a group of MIT people from, I guess, the oldest gentleman in our group of about 20 graduated from MIT in 1956, up to people who were graduated, you know, 4 days ago. And so it was kind of funny what bound us all together and made us all kind of our own little mini community or tribe is that we all believed in the possibility of, first of all, using quantitative methods and the scientific method to approach social problems. So RAND gets half its money for defense-related things, and the other half are for health and transportation and other social problems. And the second thing, besides a quantitative approach to problem solving, is just getting technology in there sooner and not waiting. So, for instance, we're on the one side, we're very supportive of government if government is bringing technology to the people through education and things like paying for the Internet. On the other hand, I have a serious bone to pick with the Food and Drug Administration because it needlessly holds up drugs. For instance, I know a billionaire named Alfred Mann. He bought a factory from Pfizer, which had this inhalable insulin called Exubra. So this factory was approved, the insulin was approved, and then he said, okay, I've just bought it. Can I now have this approved? And they go, no, you have to get it approved again. So years later, hundreds of millions of dollars tests later, boom, he can't get the same drug approved. That's the enemy of the future where we all get to try new things out and see if they work.
Wow. Yeah, that's that kind of story is it's astounding, I guess, probably how often that sort of thing happens and how pervasive that those kinds of roadblocks are. And yet we still seem to make fairly good progress. What do you think is the
I don't agree with you at all.
Can I jump in real quick?
Sure.
I was just going to say that, you know, that example is a good reason why we might expect the unregulated third world to leapfrog us at some point.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I'm going to give you an example that's going to knock your socks off.
All right.
The average life expectancy in the U.S. and Cuba is roughly the same, about 77 years. Of course, women live longer than men. But Cuba has a better infant mortality record, so they're ahead of us there. Now, here's the kicker. Ready for this? They spend $240 per person per year on their medical care, and we spend $7,000 per person per year on our medical care. So, you know, it's very amusing to me that we spend all this extra money effectively overcoming all the things that we do that are negative, for instance.
Our own infrastructure, as it were.
Well, I'll give you two things. I want to lift the embargo to Cuba, and I went to the Paul Watson, Captain Paul Watson, who's the founder of Sea Shepherd, which sunk half the Icelandic whaling fleet. And I said, will you endorse my wanting to lift the embargo of Cuba? And he was one of the only people I've met who said no. And I said, why? I was curious because I have a lot of respect for him. And he said, because Cuba is about the only place that you have no pesticides, you have no herbicides, you have an entire national program that, because they couldn't afford it, that really is organic agriculture, no genetically modified, you know, foods because they weren't allowed to import them. And if you get the embargo lifted, you ruin that. And we may need to have at least one place in the world where we have natural foods without that haven't been genetically altered. And it kind of blew me away to think that there, we might actually look at Cuba as sort of a nature preserve where we haven't meddled so much with genetic modification that we may need them for our own survival in the future.
Wow. What about the idea Stephen raised that we might see the third world leapfrog? I don't expect to see major advances coming from Cuba, although the
Why not? Here, check out what Cuba does, and I'm absolutely not endorsing this, but I'm just telling you. Like, if for instance, let's say that there's a volcano erupting in Santa Monica Bay, you can't just say, "Oh, volcanoes are horrible. Let's not have any heat from it because the volcano has killed people." I would want to go and take advantage of it. Well, Cuba has been embargoed. You can't get American medicines, and you can't get pacemakers. For instance, if a child has a pacemaker but the child dies, they're going to go and take that, wash it off, and stick it in the body of another child because we don't let them have pacemakers. But what they've done, and I've had many people tell me this, so I don't know, you don't know, but we can guess. Cuba says we ask for volunteers to test out medical drugs. Well, I talked to somebody today who's a friend of Fidel Castro who said, well, you really believe that they're volunteers? So it may be that the state forces them to, but they have treatments for hepatitis B. They have treatments for AIDS, which I'm told are actually more effective than any treatment that we use in the U.S. And there are certain famous celebrities who have AIDS who surprisingly don't seem to have AIDS anymore. And what I've been told is that they got their treatments in Cuba, but they can't admit it because they would go to jail. So the idea in a world where supposedly we're a science and technology-based nation, where people can't say what their treatment was because they'll go to jail, this to me is not the future. This is not the highest and best expression of a scientific civilization.
Do you think we've got... What's the prognosis? Do you think we'll change? Is it possible for us to turn that around?
Well, on the one hand, you have this bottom-up innovation, the citizen science revolution, which I'd love to talk about a little bit later. So I see this as a positive thing. And on the other side, you have these dwindling, what I call the no-profit zone. The day the music died. I wrote an article about the day the music died, talking about the fact that making profits, is a very rare thing in the whole history of the world. Very few companies or entities make profit for very long because whenever you make profit and you make a lot of money, someone else wants to come in. So what you really want to do is you want to try to keep other people out. And if you look at the history of the monarchy in Britain, powerful groups would, like guilds or companies, would get exclusive licenses. And they were the ones, like the British East Indies companies, could make a lot of money for a period of time. You know that the United States started as a private corporation. It was called the London Company, and they raised money for it and made it in England. Well, of course, that the company broke away when we had our independence. But effectively, everywhere I look, I see forces that would like to keep innovation from happening, because if too much innovation happens, then nobody makes a profit. And if nobody makes a profit, it's very, very difficult to go and run a country by taxing profits.
The other way to stay profitable is just keep innovating, right?
Well, yeah, but who owns those innovations? And then you have this, I would say most innovations were owned. There's a period of time in which innovations weren't owned that much. So Thomas Jefferson set up the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, I think it was 1805, and then it was 1930, so that was a big date. 1930 was the date that corporations had more patents than individuals. And now we're moving back towards that, but there comes a point at which we're now hitting a new milestone, and I don't know how to measure it. I don't know if anyone measures it, but I would say that there's an exponential increase in the number of patents and intellectual property that are not owned by anyone. I mean, we're even having a debate right now about H+. Is H+ a brand, or is H+ a generic term? I mean, that's actually literally a debate we're having right now, which astounds me, but it's a sign of the times. That you don't know who owns something, and there's this very strong, almost religious or political fervor that has to do with people being concerned about, we make things available to the public. So, for instance, H Plus as a board, and by the way, I'm not on the board. The executive director isn't on the board, which is fine with me. But so I didn't vote on this, but it voted to make everything available under Creative Commons. So if you speak at our conference, to speak at it, you have to sign a form that says that you'll let your talk be issued under Creative Commons. That's an example of giving the stuff away for free. And it has a good side if you're already making money from something else. But if you're somebody who doesn't have a job and, you know, you've spent 10 years of your life coming up with this brilliant insight, and then someone says, well, you should just give it away for free, you're probably not as enthused about that prospect.
Interesting. And yet the profit drive, as you described it earlier, is the very thing that would be slowing people down from making additional innovations. I feel like what you're describing is a paradox. And let me make sure I understand the model. So if you whoever built a better mousetrap 50 years ago is now sitting on top of their mousetrap empire, making sure nobody builds yet a better mousetrap and comes in and takes their livelihood away. Is that the basic idea?
I don't think they all get away with that, but they do it when they can. So for instance, the pharmaceutical companies. It is my own suspicion that somebody has put pressure on the FDA not to approve Alfred Mann's, his stuff. Would you know? Would I know? No, but how can you not approve something that was already previously approved, that's the same factory and the same stuff? It's just powdered insulin. How do you not approve that? What's the justification? And yet, there it is, you know? Like Tucker looking out the window when he was sued about his cars, it's like, well, look, there they are. Just look out the window, jury. The cars are right there. So there's the proof. But, you know, who knows how many innovations are kept off the table. And what makes this possible is that the U.S. FDA is the gold standard for the moment. So all these other countries think, hey, why should we staff up our FDA, our own equivalent of the FDA, when we can just piggyback on the U.S. system? That seems to work pretty well. But sooner or later, they're going to go, maybe the FDA is broken, especially for medical devices, and we're going to have to come up with our own system, and we're going to have to duplicate efforts, and we can't have the American taxpayer pay for everything. And at that point, all of a sudden, you will see this tremendous, if this scenario happens, a tremendous flood of new health devices in medicine. Where I think it's really going to impact H+, and the reason I bring it up, is because there's a certain number of operations people do because they absolutely have to do it. Like your bone is sticking out after you've, you know, hit your leg on a tree while skiing into it at 100 miles an hour.
Right.
Didn't Sonny Bono kill himself by skiing into a tree?
I believe so.
And so, you know, so let's say he survived that and he has his bone sticking out. Well, you have to do that. And then there are things where people detect a cancer cell. Well, they have to take that out. And we have better and better detection. But an exponentially increasing number of operations are cosmetic, breast augmentation, rhinoplasty, you know, nose, Botox, which apparently is like, you know, has serious health ramifications to put botulism out into the population and such in millions of people. I mean, that can't be good
Go
in
figure.
The long run.
What? That's not good for people, huh? Weird.
But then if you have, you know, people are all of a sudden saying, my eyes are kind of itchy and they don't work so well. What if I could replace it with a camera? What if I could record everything that's happening to me? You know, or what if I could replace my hip with a titanium hip, and then if I fall, it won't break? Because if someone breaks a hip within 18 months, if an older person breaks a hip, I've heard something like 30% of them are dead within 18 months. So falling and breaking your hip is one of the worst things that can happen to you if you're above the age of 70. So you might want to do preventative enhancement. And that's where the whole thing comes down to for the FDA, and are you allowed to do this? Because you're going to have people trying to put political pressure and saying, well, wait a minute, human beings shouldn't be able to do this to their bodies, just like there's a debate right now about abortion. And abortion, one aspect of abortion is, does a woman have the right to make decisions about her own body, or is it something that society has priority over, or elected officials have priority over? And ultimately, H+ has to be one organization that says, look, humans have the right to do what they want with their own bodies. And I would give two reasons for that. One is just because to be able to be told what the government to do with your body is one step away from being harvested for organs. The government says, well, you're not a good member of society, so we'll just take your organs and give them to these, you know, the party members of the elite group, which is horrific, and I don't think people have thought it through when they think government should tell you what to do with your body. The other thing is that every person who chooses to make a change in their body and then writes about it and talks about it is like the chimpanzees who are shot into space. They give us physiological data, and they serve as canaries in the coal mine. They serve as pathfinders like Marco Polo, who sent back information about China to Europe, or Christopher Columbus, who sent back information about the Indies and what he thought was India, which was actually, you know, North America and the Caribbean, to Europe. This is really useful and valuable information, and there may be somebody who makes one change, just screwing around, that all of a sudden can double the human species capacity to, let's say, live underwater or live out in the vacuum of space or survive a fire. I mean, who knows unless we allow ourselves to experiment.
So in your view, it sounds like you think that the change is going to come from people working outside the system rather than making effective reforms within the system?
Well, it depends on what you mean by system. So what do you mean by the system?
I mean our federal government of, you know, our FDA and the regulations that exist. Do you anticipate that we're going to throw that off and have a country in which people are allowed to volunteer for medical treatments that are experimental and perform these kinds of procedures on themselves, or will that all have to happen more or less in a gray market or a black market before it gains sufficient acceptance to become something that's actually legal and official?
I could probably talk for hours and hours about that question. I have like 10 different responses I want to give you. It's a very layered and nuanced question. So let me start by parsing a little bit. If you mean by system the federal government, then I would say my answer is kind of like that question during Prohibition when a politician who is particularly squirrely was asked if he's in favor or against alcohol. And he said something like, if by alcohol you mean that lightener of men's mood and that icebreaker that allows for the fellowship of men to move forth between strangers, then I'm for it. And if by alcohol you mean the scourge of men's livers and the destroyer of families and divorce and unfathered children and auto accidents, then I'm against it. So which alcohol are you?
Good politician, yeah. Okay.
So I would say if by government you mean the part of the government that funded the internet and paid, got Paul Baran at RAND to make, you know, the concept of packet switch networks and Aloha Net in Hawaii, and paid Vince Cerf and Bob Kahn to make IPv4 in 1973, and set up ISI and Marina Del Rey to hand out blocks of addresses. And overall, $50 million worth of internet led to $500 billion worth of extra tax revenues between 1990 and 2000. Then I say, by gum, I'm in favor of the system. And if by the system you mean something where the FDA can kick back and say, you know, we don't see any benefit to this. We don't see how you're really adding value to what's already out there, then I'm against it. Because to me, putting out a commercial product, including a medical product, is protected by the First Amendment. Products and services are speech. They are a way of communicating. They are a way of expressing oneself. And so I think that they're covered. And ultimately, you can put warnings. You can say, look, the government doesn't back this. We don't support it. It might kill you. Put whatever label you want. But ultimately, people need to be able to put things out there and try them out, especially if you have something where there isn't a cure, like hepatitis B. Why would you keep something that is proven off the shelf? There's a guy whose brother had hepatitis B. He went to Cuba, came back with their treatment. It worked, and they both were on trial from the federal government. It's like, how does that help our society? Well, it's trading with the enemy. It's like, oh, well, okay, you're trading with the enemy if you have a base in Guantanamo and you have a real estate deal. So, you know, you can't pick and choose. You either nobody can trade with the enemy, the supposed enemy, or everyone can trade with it. To go and just say, oh, only privileged institutions and privileged companies can do it, like Tyson's Chicken gets to do it, you know, but Foster's Farms does not, that's just absurd. So I guess I want to say wherever government has the possibility of corrupt monopolies, keeping new information, new products being out there, that we should be hyper-vigilant, and that the government agencies should go through just as much hell to gain new powers as they have to keep people from bringing new products to market. It's sort of a mirror, a reciprocity.
Okay, well, that makes sense. We're at about the halfway point, so why don't we swing it around and let's talk a little bit about this idea of the citizen scientist. I know that that's of thematic importance to the upcoming summit. So why don't we introduce that idea as a way of getting into our discussion, our sneak peek of the summit proper. I know that there's some genesis of this idea in a piece that our friend Joseph Jackson did in H Plus magazine, but could you just briefly tell us what is a citizen scientist and why is that concept of particular importance to us?
Well, sure. The origin of this was that I went to a conference that Todd Huffman and Cody Marks Bailey and Reichardt von Wolscheid put together called Bill. Bill is sort of the open source low rent version of TED.
Of TED,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
we've talked to Reichardt about that.
TED is the granddaddy. TED is awesome and supreme and wonderful, but you know the idea of Bill is it happens sort of around the same time. So people who didn't go to Bill go to TED can still hang out and have friendship, friendly conversations. I went to this Greek restaurant and sat with Joseph Jackson and his colleague, I think it's Guillermo from Venezuela, who was making this thermocycler, something that would cost like $5,000, and we're making it so you could make it for $15-$20. And I was so blown away by that, and I said, well, why? And they said, well, so citizen scientists can use it. And at that moment, my brain caught fire, and I thought, wow, so the laboratory equipment costs can go down so much if you use this open source and you use Craigslist and other things. And all of a sudden, people who are curious can go out and find things out. They can find out, well, let's say you saw Food Inc. and you wonder whether your burger has E. coli. Imagine being able to whip out a homemade device and just test your burger right there at the table. I mean, that doesn't exist right now. Now, Joseph Jackson says that a citizen scientist is anyone who uses the scientific method to investigate themselves or their environment to answer a particular question or satisfy their curiosity. And he gives his examples, people like Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and Edward Jenner, who, you know, observed the milkmaids didn't get smallpox because they were, you know, going and milking the cows, and even if the cows had cowpox. So, you know, these people who have found things out in the natural world and were able to bring them out. My favorite is Gregor Mendel. I mean, I saw an exhibit in Singapore that purported to be a replica of his garden. I was shocked at how small it was. It wouldn't even be the footage covered by a mattress. And yet, from that, he derived the basic principles of inheritance and traits and dominant traits and so on. And, you know, look at what's happening in our world based on that knowledge. And so I get a thrill from the idea that as a society we will value people who go out and spend their time finding scientific knowledge. And there are millions of people doing bird watching and millions of people doing astronomical observations and millions of people going in and trying out biological experiments. And I would like that to be hundreds of millions, all knowing that there's a possibility that this could be abused. And so part of the reason for this Rise of the Citizen Scientist conference is to say, hey, yes, you are amazing, you are incredible, you are powerful, but you have to, like, you know, the whole Spider-Man comic, with great power comes great responsibility. If you want to be able to hang with your peers, you need to be socially responsible. You need to not hurt people. You need to not hinder them. You need to not cause damage or go crazy with this stuff. And I got that sense from the work that they were doing at Foresight Institute. They were, you know, even before nanotechnology really existed, they were thinking, what could go wrong, and how do we try to create principles that would keep it from going wrong? And I admired that sort of thinking about the solution and then thinking about the problem that could come out of the solution ahead of time. And we're definitely there with the rise of the citizen scientist.
You know, Stephen, this discussion of the citizen scientist reminds me of so many of the discussions we've had over the last few weeks about the maker movement, the idea of...
Very complimentary.
These are guys that, you know might be in their garage somewhere, and maybe they're not studying, you know, genetics like Mendel, but they might be putting together a homemade fab lab or something like that to make 3D products or whatever, and then upload the plans to the internet so other people can try it and improve on it. And these tinkerers could be a huge source of information and expansion of our knowledge in the future. So that's an interesting subculture that relates, doesn't it?
I look at Cory Doctorow. Cory Doctorow has the book Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, which says in the future that the currency was reputation, called Woofie, W-H-U-F-F-I-E. And Cory Doctorow also has a book called, which I'm looking at as I'm talking to you, called Makers, which is about
that. We actually had him on a few weeks ago talking about that.
Wow, you have good taste in guests.
Clearly.
And I have to say that there's complementarity between the maker community and the citizen scientist community, because the citizen scientist could go to the makers and say, can you make me this? And because I want to try some experiment, and I don't have $50,000 to pay to this scientific supply house, and maybe you can help me to put it together, and then, you know, in return, I'll tell you what I did with it, and you can say, hey, look at my device. Maybe you want to buy it too. And there's one person who sort of has the big picture of how all these things relate. His name is Brian Bishop, and I've told him he's like the potentially the greatest resource to bring all these communities together, because he transcribed every word of the last H+ summit. And when you consider just the different specialized vocabularies alone, I mean, to be able to even attempt to spell everything someone says is heroic. But he's working on open manufacturing and open biology, and also interested in citizen science. And so I think that guys like him are the future.
It's astounding to think that these trends we've observed in, and for me, it started back in the 80s. I was working for a company that was selling desktop publishing software. And we were very philosophical about what we were doing. We really saw this as an opportunity to help change the world, because we're putting the ability to produce published material into the hands of anybody who wants to have it. It was, you know, it's just like this new paradigm of publishing, desktop publishing, being able to kind of deindustrialize the whole process of publishing. And throughout the internet age, it seems that we have seen so much more of that kind of handing off of, or assuming, I should say, of important roles by all of us. You know, Stephen and I like to talk about, here we are, you know, we're citizen broadcasters, right? When we do this program, we're citizen publishers when we blog. And
done, nice. I like it. I approve of your conceptual integration of the concept. It works for me. I like it, and I hadn't even thought of it.
Yeah, and but to me, it seems like the really exciting thing is to think, I hadn't even thought about citizen scientists, to think of, you know, thousands, millions of people doing independent work, and, you know, thousands, millions of inventors, right, who actually have the ability to fabricate new products and to work these ideas. To think of that capability that used to belong to large institutions, to large governments, and to large businesses, to you know, well-funded, wealthy entities, now passing into the hands of individuals. This is just it seems a very exciting trend.
Well, if you look at how much progress was done. I was watching a program on the Big Bang, and it said it took us 2,000 years to put together this idea with that idea with that idea, you know, to come up with the whole Big Bang theory. And I find that the explosion of knowledge that will come out of citizen science, if it goes where I think it will go, it will increase by 2, 3, 4, 5 orders of magnitude the already astounding amount of scientific output that's coming. But, you know, with things like, what is it? There's two laws. One of them, one rule that says how many people you can know, and it says it's about 150 people that you can know. There's some kind of limit. And then there's Dunbar's limit, which is the number of people who you can find something in common with if you have the right tools. And the Dunbar number is much bigger than the other number. And similarly, you can have these micro communities where somebody might have a scientific finding that's only interesting to 100 people, but they'll find each other. You know, they'll be put in touch. Like, for instance, Joseph Jackson told me about this idea of the citizen scientist. And so, you know, I said, okay, my conference, I can go in and call it what I want. I'll call it Rise of the Citizen Scientist. I asked Joseph if that was okay. He said, sure, it's great. And then I met Darlene Cavalier. And Darlene Cavalier is science cheerleader. She was actually a cheerleader for the for one of the sports teams in Philadelphia and is beautiful and smart and worked for 10 years for Discover Magazine on all kinds of, you know, promoting science so that the public could understand it. And that's now her life's work. And she publishes things that are right about all about this. And I just want people to meet each other so that they can kind of say, hey, this occupation of promoting citizen science is itself a valid occupation, just like doctor or lawyer. I was very surprised to hear from Darlene that there's never been a conference focused on the citizen scientist. The reason I find that astonishing is just look at what 22 people in the Homebrew Computer Club. Was it Homebrew Computer Club or Homebrew Computer Society? I forget. But, you know, this included Bill Gates and Paul Allen and Lee Feldenstein, the guy who designed the Osborne One. Osborne, when he did these computers, it did $100 million revenue the first year. I think
right.
All 22 of these guys, who, by the way, do you know what the original purpose of the Homebrew Computer Club was, according to Paul Allen when I talked to him? It was to share science fiction books that they wouldn't have to go in and buy them individually. They would just pay the library for them. So if 22 of these nerds, these uber nerds, were able to go over and create the personal computer revolution out of that, I mean, what can 22 million, you know, genetic engineering citizen scientists do for the human condition and human evolution? Well, I'd say quite a bit more. And yet, it's almost impossible to imagine a group of people having a bigger impact than the personal computing people.
It sure is. But it's exciting to think where that's led. And it seems to me that it has led to this this growing community of citizen scientists. We have the network now. We have the ability to connect with each other, and we've got tools to make this sort of thing happen. Speaking of which, can you say a little something about what it is that you're doing on Facebook? I think it's really interesting the use that you're making of Facebook. I mentioned it in my introduction of you, and could you give us an update? How many friends do you have on Facebook? Speaking of those laws of how many people you can connect with.
Sure. Okay. I have 3,652 friends as we speak, and I just a couple days ago I marked the 3,500th anniversary. And I actually rarely put out a friend request, and I reject most of them. Like if there are people who have just a couple of common friends and they don't have a picture of themselves, they have some design. I went to a party the other night, Department of Flying Cars. It's a group that's sort of roughly a spinoff of Mindshare LA called Tuxedo Tyrants. People, I don't know why the Tyrants is there, but the Tuxedo's there. And I find tattoos fascinating. I don't have any tattoos. And I find science tattoos really fascinating because it's just like, why would you have a science tattoo? But somebody had a Fibonacci sequence graph, you know, this spiral expanding out. And I was talking to her about it. Her friend came up and said, don't talk to him. That's Alex Lightman. He unfriended me on Facebook. And, like, and I'm just thinking, you know, my standards for having friends is so low that if I unfriended you, you're a terrible person. I remember exactly why I did, because she was giving me a hard time about something, and I noticed that she had this creepy doll, and I find, like, creepy old dolls, 50-year-old dolls, being, you know, terrible, so I unfriended her. But you ask what I do on Facebook. I'll start by telling you what Paul Grassoff said authoritatively. He said, I personally account for 10% of all the posts on Facebook out of 400 million people. Now, it's a joke, but there is something called Grader. Grader.com, you know, Facebook.grader.com, mm-hmm. where you can look at the quote-unquote power of your Facebook network. So if you go with the assumption that anybody with a big network has tried to see the relative status of their network. Out of 400 million people on Facebook, I have the 169th, quote-unquote, most powerful network. Well, but I'm not a multi-level marketer, so I don't use Facebook to sell anything, with the sole exception of trying to get people to come to H Plus Summit, Rise of the Citizen Scientist. But the way to do that is to publish interviews with people. Like, for instance, there's an interview published today on H Plus of me and my incredible chairman of H Plus, David Orban, and another one you mentioned before with Joseph Jackson. So what I'm doing with Facebook is I'm trying to find a community of people who are able to, it comes down to the whole operational tempo thing. If people really can't stand all my posts, then they unfriend me, which is good, so they're filtered. And then I get to be myself. I get to be myself with lots of what I call elbow room, unfiltered, and I say what I want about any subject, and the people who are there, you know, they can put up with it. They can live with it. So if I were just posting meek, mild posts once in a while, I would have hit my 5,000 limit like a year ago. But as it is, these are people who have, you know, they stick with me through massive posting, and they at some point they go, oh, wow, this is really cool. I know that you like this and this and this, so why don't you come to that? Like, for instance, I post about Lost, and a friend of mine, Kate Park, says, hey, Daniel Dae Kim, one of the actors who plays Jun, is speaking, so why don't you come to hear him speak? And, you know, I get to ask him a question, and people bring things to me, sort of like the gifts of the Magi. They're, you know, mm-hmm. they're bringing me the frankincense and myrrh in the form of really cool, specialized information that you would only know if you had read hundreds of my posts. So what I'm trying to do is to train people what information I'm interested in and what information I'm not interested in. And it actually seems to be working.
Amazing, amazing stuff. I had read the interview. I think the H Plus interview about the conference in which you were talking. I think talking about it there a little bit, and just this idea of building a progressively more intelligent network that you're training along the way is just such a novel use of the technology. It's no wonder that you're 169th. Actually, I'm surprised you're not even ranked higher than that, making really excellent, innovative use of the technology.
Oh, thank you. Well, if you look at the people, a lot of them are multi-level marketing people, and they have read techniques for going and doing it, and they've built their lists through using mailing lists. If you go to courses on marketing your books or marketing your seminars, one phrase that's pretty common is whoever has the best mailing list wins. So this is one of the few networks that's this big on Facebook that was built entirely organically without walking in a mental crouch, without my censoring myself, without my really caring that much what someone says, and occasionally having somebody, you know, just blow up and do crazy things. Like, I met a person that I consider crazy who made absurd allegations and stuff. And so I went through and looked at the mutual friends, and I looked at the ones that I didn't know whether, you know, I would trust them. And so I just did a mass unfriending, because anybody who would not have unfriended this crazy person, I didn't want to be friends with that person.
Right.
So for
right.
me, it's an exploration in kind of like who do you want in your tribe? Who do you want in your, if you could have a tribe of or a small town of 5,000 people, because that's the limit right now on Facebook, who do you want to be in your town with you? You may not interact with them that much, but if you have a choice, who do you have? If you could choose any 5,000 people on Earth, and so that's what I'm putting together on Facebook. And I'm doing it, you know, one science, technology, political, geographical, action-oriented post at a time.
I was just going to say, I just joined that tribe because Alex accepted my invitation during the program, by the way.
Multitask. That's Alex Lightman right there. He's probably put a couple posts up too while he's been.
I actually try to find at least $10,000 worth of value. This is one of my operating principles. I don't know if no one's really noticed it, but I try to find about $10,000 worth of value to give each week, like roughly. So if people read my post for a week. For instance, I just went to RAND, and I put, wow, at the MIT Club Tour of RAND, which has 800 researchers publishing away, was thrilled to learn that RAND's publications are free if you want the digital versions. So they have all these publications, hundreds and hundreds of them, that cost $25 to $30. And they're free if you want the digital versions, if you want the PDFs of them. I mean, that's a huge win to find
that
out. That's amazing.
Yeah.
You never have to buy a book again if you want nonfiction books about policy analysis and you don't want to spend any money. There they are. Or
you're set for life with the Rand Collection, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, or like Scientific American, all you can eat Scientific American articles for like $30.
I did not know that. I'm going to have to check that out.
I just got the new issue of Scientific American, and I was feeling very chuffed, thinking, wow, this is amazing. I mean, I'm paying pennies for this delicious information.
Great. Okay, well, listen, we got about 10 minutes left, so let's get into the H-Plus Summit. It's coming up June 12th and 13th. It's going to be in the Boston area at Harvard University.
Yeah.
Tell us about where it's going to be and generally what's going to be happening.
Sure. Well, the H-Plus Summit, the first one, now, there were transvision conferences, but they were before my time. I never attended one. But, we reinvented the World Transhumanist Association is H+. So the first H+ event under that name that was our own, solo event was the H+ Summit in Irvine. People loved it. I never had so many people look at me with love and say, oh, my God, this is so great. Thank you so much. And
Alex,
so,
I can tell you that the week after that event, we had PJ Manny on the show. She's a frequent guest. And, Stephen, would you say she raved or gushed about it?
Well, I think she raved and gushed. I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
I wish I had been there.
She has very high standards. So a number of people approached me and said, hey, I want to help you with the next summit. And the offer that I got that I liked the best was from amazing young man named Kevin Jane, who was setting up the Harvard Future Society, and it persuaded Harvard to let him make his program of study in transhumanism. And he was amazed with us because all the people on his reading list were on the board of directors of H+. So it's like, we have this amazing brain trust within the board of H+, the past board and the current board. And so he got, to actually get to know us. And meanwhile, he is helping with the organizing and is primary organizer and got us the science hall at Harvard to do this. So the actual organizers of this are the students at Harvard, which I think is neat. And Harvard, I went to Harvard, to the Kennedy School of Government. I didn't get a degree. My degree is from MIT. But I finished all my degree requirements in 2.5 years, and I had this scholarship money still left over. So I just took a bunch of graduate courses, as long as I had the money for it. And he has set it up so that we are, we get to take something that is the oldest educational institution in America, Harvard, and to take the newest educational curriculum, which is transhumanism, and bring them together. And anytime you can take something traditional and sort of reinvent it or expose it to something like this, you have the potential for, a thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis to come out of it. And that appealed to me tremendously. I mean, my natural tendency for an East Coast conference would have been to do it at MIT. I feel, of course, closer to MIT because I did a lot more there, and it just fits MIT so well. But
it sounds like an MIT kind of thing.
But it wasn't such a clear fit with Harvard, and I thought that would give people pause and make them go, wow, wonder what's going on here. I have to check this out. And Are You Serious, the editor of H+ Magazine, today put out, Ray Kurzweil coming to Harvard, and I think that's pretty cool because, by having it at Harvard, people at Harvard are going to start taking these ideas a little bit more under consideration. And hopefully it'll make MIT jealous, and they'll ask me to have it at MIT next year.
Yeah, or next quarter as you go from the six-month model. In our chat room, the prediction was that you're going to quickly go from a six-month model to a quarterly model on these.
That's unlikely. I did the IPv6 conferences with a six-month cycle. I'll tell you what the gating factor is. The gating factor is not what you would think. The gating factor is getting speakers to get their photos and to get their materials in. It takes so long to get speakers to get their materials in, unless they're like Ray, who's does speaking all the time. Most people don't have it together. I mean, you would not believe how many speakers say, well, I don't really have a good photo. But that's what happens when you have people who have been not professional speakers. Like, hey, if you want someone to speak with you on how to increase your sales by 10% or how to do, Stephen Covey type goodness and
you can line them up pretty quick, I bet, right? Yeah.
Oh yeah, those guys all got their photos. But if you have somebody who's at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, you know, and like could make unleash something on the world that could replace every Indian in a call center and cause 300,000 of them to lose their jobs. That guy doesn't have a photo. He's coding away.
Right. So, he's busy being a scientist and a citizen, and then being a presenter on top of that is just that's a tall order.
Yeah, and also I would have to say that, you know, I attend, the closest thing I came to attending TED was you can rent a feed, like you can rent a hotel room. So a bunch of my friends and I rented a hotel room and a video feed, and I saw the TED Talks, and the speakers are TED speakers, but TED also kind of, you know, has other things that don't have to do with science and technology. And it's kind of cool, but I'm not as interested in, let's say, hearing a musician or an actor or a comedian or something, because I can get that in a lot of places. You just don't get the full-blown, brand-new Ray Kurzweil, plus Stephen Wolfram, plus, you know, Andrew Hessel at Pink Army, plus, you know, Nolan Bushnell and Rob Tursik, who runs Oprah Winfrey Network. You don't get all these people in one place at one time unless you go to a conference. And so the reason to come to this conference is it's going to be, I would say, it's people, it's 50 people who lead science and technology movements and can express themselves well enough that a million people will go, oh, I want to change my life and make that happen. Okay, and all of a sudden they've built their own army. But none of the people at this conference are particularly power hungry, so they don't do all the things that they don't run for office. They don't run for the Senate because they're not trying to have power over other people. They want people to have power over themselves. And so you have to sort of kind of train them a little bit to do that minimum stuff that you have to do to communicate who they are and package them a little bit, because these are not people who focus on the packaging of themselves. They focus on the real stuff, the real science, the real invention, the real products, the real books. And I would say that out of this group of 50 people, I would be very surprised. I've asked someone to count it up. I haven't heard back. I'd be very surprised to hear that they had published fewer than 200 books,
wow,
you know, between them, because there's just so many authors. If, you know, I would say the vast majority of them are authors of pretty compelling works of nonfiction.
There you go. Okay, it's the mother load, folks. Listen, we're gonna put the links up for the event, and you've still got room for additional people, right? So people can sign up
and
still attend. Okay, so we're gonna, and I understand that there's some kind of break people can get on the admission, or no? Is that
well,
deal
yeah,
expired?
The way that I set it up is I use Geoffrey Moore's pricing categories for technology evolution. So I started it at $150 a ticket for 75 tickets, and half that price for students. And then it goes up $50 every time we sell 25 tickets. I mean, sorry, 75 tickets. So you can still get it $200 or $100 if you're a student, and that's a great price.
Okay, so listen.
I guess there are about 50 speakers for TED, I think I counted. There are 50 speakers for this conference, but it costs $200 instead of $6,000.
Yes, that's a heck of a bargain. It costs $200 now, but as more people sign up, the price is only going to increase. So, folks, if you're thinking about going, follow those links. They'll be up on the Speculist in the show notes. And Alex, we'd like to have you back on maybe afterwards, and we can do a debrief at some point if you think you might be available.
It would be my pleasure and my honor. And you guys are great to keep up with the whole rapid fire and stops and starts and turns of this whole thing. It's kind of hard to describe it all because it doesn't fit within a method, a 1 to 10 series of steps or a methodology or an established field. So you're two of the rare people who can deal with something that's so unstructured and evolving.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for being with us, Alex. Best of success to you with the summit.
Thank you.
All right, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The song is Blowing My Mind by Kyle.
That couldn't be more appropriate. Kyle sings Blowing My Mind. Thank you so much for putting that together, Stephen. Thanks once again to our guest, Alex Lightman, to everyone listening live, and to everyone who listens to us via recording. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be back next week on Tuesday evening, not Wednesday, so look forward to being with you all then. And until then, live to see it.